Good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. I want to thank Justin and Barney and Scott for filling in for me in various ways. And thank you all for your continued service in the Lord's kingdom. Thank you for the projects like the coats I saw when I walked in and the other ways in which you all are involved in serving. I believe Brother Dennis Smith told me one time that Psalm 1 is either his favorite psalm or his favorite scripture. Dennis, you can call this week and remind me which one it was. Larry told me that Psalm 1 is on the back of his business van. I have a book entitled Favorite Psalms. A few of the psalms are in it. Psalm 1 is. I have another book entitled Great Chapters of the Bible. Psalm 1's in it. And more, I can see why this psalm should be written on everyone's hearts, starting with mine. Somebody wrote that Psalm 1 may be regarded as the preface psalm because it sets forth in principle not only the whole of the psalms, but the contents of the entire Bible. That's quite a statement. The preface is what an author puts before his first chapter to kind of set the stage or to explain where everything else is headed. And a preface to life results from this. If the Bible is God's heart open to us to try to introduce himself to us and to let us know what we need to understand before the other instructions he's going to give us about life are going to make any sense. And if Psalm 1 is the preface to the contents of the entire Bible, then this psalm is appropriately a preface to life. This is what I need to have in my mind in order to make sense out of all the confusing things that go on around me in the world this week. This is what parents are concerned with having in the hearts of their children, more so than a right argument about this or that issue, but this worldview, this view of reality. This is what the church needs to have in mind when we're trying to talk about reconciliation, when we think about showing people that in Jesus we come back to what we were meant to be, then this psalm is the right background for that understanding. Psalm 1 tells us really that life comes down to what we delight in and what we think on. You'll remember from Christmas just a while back, you do remember a month ago, right? You got these gifts and you opened them up and then you tried to express your delight for the kindness of whoever the giver was, maybe the delight in the gift itself. This would be delight that God has cared enough about us to make himself, his own heart, known to us. As we've just sung, these words come from God's own heart. Justin gave me a book a couple years ago entitled, You Are What You Love. That would go with this idea that is key to this psalm and what this psalm tells us. Here's what the psalm says. Please notice Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like the chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Let's think about what that psalm says. First question to ask is how it's to be taken. Now, what are we to make of this passage? When you look through it, it starts to dawn on you, this is really not a prayer. It's not really a song. It's not a command. It's more in the nature of a statement. It's a statement about human existence. It's an assertion about reality. It's saying to us, this is how life works. When we talk about walking by faith and not by sight, this is the kind of thing that's at stake. Can we see that this is how life works, regardless of how people around us think it works in the time where we live? It's like, I think this psalm is like the outside pieces to a big old jigsaw puzzle. Nancy called me a couple weeks ago and told me somebody had given her a 1,000-piece puzzle, and that's just too many. She said, but you know, if you sit down with a big old puzzle like that, if you can find the outside pieces and the corner pieces, then you figure out that if you get this right, then everything else starts fitting into place. And that's how I see Psalm 1. You get this right, and everything else starts fitting into place. It's a statement. And then notice about this psalm that the first and the last words of it really establish the possibilities of life. It starts with blessed is, and it ends with will perish. That's quite a contrast, isn't it? Something happens in between here that tells the difference between those two outcomes. And if you think about it, it's pretty clearly evaluating the present ways of going about life in terms of what the results are going to be. The first word would be kind of paraphrased, how rewarding is the life of? And it goes ahead to describe the godly person. And it ends with how empty and useless is the life of? And it's describing the wicked way at that point. And both of these conditions are going to be illustrated in the middle of the psalm, as we'll see as we go along. And the third thing to notice, just kind of getting our bearings here, how to take this, is that the contrast in the psalm is really between the ways, the two different ways that result in either blessed or perished. There's the way of the righteous and the way of the wicked. And in the view of this psalm, isn't it interesting that there's not a third alternative? There's the way of the righteous, there's the way of the wicked. No matter whether you believe that or not, how many options you think you could create, in the view of this psalm, there are these two ways. And what this psalm is saying to us is that it's the way of life that the person himself chooses for himself that's decisive in how things are going to result. It's not what he looks like, or what he has, or what people who lived before him did, or what's currently approved by the culture around. It's the choice a person makes for himself about the way he's going to live, the way he's going to take for his life. So if there's the way of the righteous and the way of the wicked, what's the difference between them? What's really, when you get right down to it, the difference between the way of the righteous and the way of the wicked? I think a lot of times we evaluate in terms of the symptoms instead of the disease with this, or instead of the real condition. It says in verse 2, that this is the key statement in my opinion, the righteous delight in the law of the Lord. Or the righteous delight in the instruction of the Lord. You'll notice the translation footnote may say. The law, the word for law in verse 2, which I've paraphrased a bit, means the instruction or direction or the teaching from which the way and the will of the Lord can be learned. So it's talking about what kind of instruction, direction, or teaching I accept and regard as reality. And delight, in this statement, the righteous delight in the law of the Lord, delight means that their whole being approves and endorses it, approves of what the Lord's instructions are, endorses what the Lord says about reality, and takes that way as it goes along. It's a little bit like the tasting of food, which I'm still good at. I still can do that very well. You taste it, and your highest compliment to the cook is, that is so good. And I don't make light of the Lord's instruction, but in a moral sense, in a spiritual sense, when you can take in what the Lord says and sit back and think about it and say, that is so right. It's so true. That's what I want for my life. Then you're on the path of delight that we're talking about here. It's the way of the righteous, Psalm 1 says, to delight in the guidance of the wise and loving God, and to hear what He says as always for our good, and to see the application of it in every part of life, and to recognize it as how things really work. Whether it's family, or whether it's speech, or whether it's other issues that go on in life, to see that what God said was right all along. I think I can see an illustration of delighting in the instruction of the Lord and what we've sung a while ago from Psalm 25. Look over in Psalm 25 for a minute. This psalm starts, "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you." You recognize those words, right? Skip down to verse 4 with me, and I think you see the spirit of delight I'm talking about here. "Make me to know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in the truth, in your truth, and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all day long." Somebody who thinks this way believes that to be able to be taught by God and to be able to walk in His way, that's going to be the thing that rescues me and makes my life what the Lord wants it to be. It continues, "Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from of old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord." It's asking that God will remember what has always been. That's His own nature, His steadfast love and mercy, and not my temporary journey, which sometimes has been characterized by sins and transgressions, mistakes and failures. And then it's asking God to act on the basis of who He is and not on the basis of who I am, because I already have decided that the best thing for me would be for Him to have His way in my life. And it goes ahead to say, "Good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, He instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble His way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep His covenant and His testimonies." That's from Psalm 25. That's delighting in the law of the Lord. The righteous person acts on the word of the righteous God and begins to feel at home in the ways of that God, and he finally settles down among those who love that God. It becomes who he is and how he sees life and where he stands, and not just his religious obligation, but reality. On the other hand, this psalm simply says, verse 4, the first phrase of verse 4, the wicked are not so. This is the most telling comment on the way of the wicked. A wicked person delights in his own will. The instruction of the Lord holds no attraction to him and has no influence on him. The wicked seek out and approve and endorse those who affirm their own preferences and opinions and ways and have no space for anybody to disagree with them. That's according to this psalm. There's no being disciplined by any fixed point of reality. There's only restless, pointless motion. Notice walking, standing, sitting. There's a process of decline and hardening. First, there's listening to the counsel of the ungodly, and next, there's standing in the way of the sinful, and then it's sitting in the seat of the scornful. And if you're watching, the way to which the wicked are drawn inevitably produces a culture in which the wicked are surrounded by people who accept the same approach to life. Self-will. It's a culture that's characterized by ungodly action, sinful lifestyle, and a scornful worldview. And that doesn't matter whether it's the Roman Empire of the second or third century, or whether it's the United States of America in the 21st, or whether it's some country in Europe or Africa or Asia, or wherever. These two ways are determined by what people delight in and listen to and let their identity be fashioned by. So where do these two ways lead? That'd be the next question that needs to be thought about a minute, I think. Where do they lead? This psalm is beloved because of its illustration of reality. The way of the righteous is blessed like a tree planted by streams of water. Kay and I have made some trips to Wyoming to see Sherry over the years, and we drive out through the never-ending state of Nebraska, and you get out toward the other side of it, and then you get into Wyoming, and you can tell wherever there's a stream of water. You know how? And all that plains of emptiness, there'll be big old cottonwood trees along the route of a stream of water. And that's what I picture here. A life lived in the way of the righteous, which delights in the instruction of the Lord, has resources to draw upon that'll sustain it through whatever nature brings, whatever reality brings against it. It'll be productive. It yields its fruit in its season, the psalm says. It doesn't wither under distress. It's capable of enduring life. In other words, its leaves don't wither up. And then it says of the one who walks in the way of the righteous, in all that he does, in his delight in the instruction of the Lord, in all that he does, he prospers. Now put that in the context of the Psalms for a moment. If you think about it, you realize this is not meaning that there aren't any hard times or hurtful things or hostile forces for him to face. God's not offering us a deal. If you'll just put down your roots here by this stream of water. If you'll just delight in my instruction, then I promise you none of these things will happen. No, it's not saying that. What it's saying is, I promise you that in the long run, this is the life that endures. It's the life that tends toward fulfillment. It's the way of living that allows succeeding generations to have some sense of honor and decency and order and fulfillment. On the other hand, it says, the way of the wicked perishes like the chaff the wind drives away. That's the end of verse 4. So a tree planted by streams of water, or like chaff the wind drives away. There's another picture like this over in Jeremiah 17. But in this case, it's telling us that a life can take the way of the wicked, and for a while it'll look like it's full of life and a part of the harvest, because after all, it was advised and accepted and approved by the influencers of the time. But then reality keeps moving along. God has placed His order in the world, and the world works a certain way. Reality keeps moving along, and this way of living withers in its seasons. There's a difference between a young person who's done all of the currently fashionable, acceptable time and things and all of that, and somebody who gets to my end of life and lives with that. I heard a guy say, this is no comment on tattoos now, but I did hear somebody say one time, there are going to be a lot of sagging tattoos one of these days. Life does move along. And that, this is what this is saying to us about morally and spiritually and socially. There's an undeniable process. It withers in its seasons. It becomes useless, and its uselessness becomes apparent. And then there isn't anything in it to keep it from being driven by the wind. That's the illustration. And the illustration comes from their process of harvesting grain. There'd be, on whatever the windiest place they could find, there'd be maybe a big flat rock or something that would serve as a threshing floor. And then the farmer would come with his hired hands with winnowing forks, in which they would dip into the piles of grain on the threshing floor and throw it up into the air like that, and the chaff would be blown away by the wind, and the grain would fall on the floor. And when that process was all done and only grain was left, then it's harvested and it's made use of and sustains a life. Last week, I was with you by live stream. Last week, Justin read for us from Luke chapter 3 about what John the Baptist said people should do back then in his ministry. If you go down to verse 17 of Luke chapter 3, here's the way John finished his urging. Speaking about the Christ, he said, His winnowing fork is in His hand to clear the threshing floor and to gather the wheat into His barn, but the chaff He will burn with unquenchable fire. Psalm 1 says the chaff is the life lived in the way of the wicked, where there was no delight in the law of the Lord and no interest in who the Lord is or His involvement in life. And if Luke 3:17 sounds harsh to you, probably it's a good idea to ask, why is Psalm 1 saying it works like this? I think this is a useful thing to consider. And that brings us down to verse 6. And now for the first time, the Lord becomes the actor. For the first time in Psalm 1, the Lord Himself is the subject of the verb. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous. It works like this because the Lord knows the way of the righteous. In other words, now His presence defines reality. He has built Himself into the order of life. Knows, the word for knows, is a word of relationship. And what Psalm 1 is telling us is the Lord delights in people delighting in Him. People delight in the instruction of the Lord, and He knows, He delights, He relates to them. He takes an active interest in their way. He watches over them. He cares and He guides. He approves. And all through the Bible, this idea is present. Psalm 34:15, referenced also in 1 Peter 3. His eyes are on the righteous, and His ears are open to their prayers. That's what it means when the Lord knows them. He's Nahum verse 1, chapter 1, verse 7. He's a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in Him. That the Lord knows means that for the righteous, their heritage will remain forever. I read that from Psalm 37 and verse 18. On the other hand again, notice that verse 5 says, therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. Notice the contrast between the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the wicked will not stand. It's not that when it says the Lord knows the righteous, it doesn't mean He doesn't know the wicked or that He doesn't care in sense of just knowing, but He has no relationship with them because they've refused to allow Him to be involved or to approve or to bless their lives. Those who walk the way of the wicked in the perspective of Psalm 1 have already taken their stand somewhere else, you remember, in the way of sinners, we read back up in verse 1. They've already taken their seat in another congregation, that is, in the seat of the scoffers, we read earlier in this psalm. It's thought-provoking that in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 7, you come down to verse 23, and Jesus speaks of the time and the judgment when He says, I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. That makes sense when you understand it in light of Psalm 1. You never delighted in the instruction of the Lord. I never knew you. You never stood with me. You never sat in the congregation of my people. I never knew you. You weren't fashioned by God's law, but by lawlessness. I never knew you. In that way, I think it's safe to say that Psalm 1 is not just a preface to the Psalms or the Bible or to life, but Psalm 1 is an introduction to Jesus, actually. And more, I think this. Just consider the Sermon on the Mount for a minute, Matthew chapters 5 through 7. The Sermon on the Mount reflects Psalm 1, I believe. As in Psalm 1, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus started with blessed and ended with, and great was the fall of it. And in between, He taught about fulfilling the law. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus spoke of a father who knows what His children need and of a people who want more than anything for His will to be done in their lives. That's Matthew 6 and verse 32 and then verse 10. And in the Sermon on the Mount, as in Psalm 1, Jesus offered a choice between two gates to two ways that lead to two very different destinies. And then He offered an invitation to enter the way that leads to life. Matthew 7, verses 13 and 14. And in a very real way, Christ is Himself the way, which answers to the delight of the righteous in Psalm 1. The delight of the righteous is to be able to go in the Lord's way. Jesus comes saying, "My food is to do the will of Him who sent me and to accomplish His work." John 4, verse 34. And Jesus does it even to the point of giving Himself. And even though He knows no sin, He becomes sin in our behalf that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. And then He invites us to follow Him, to live in Him, to be a part of Him, to be among His people. It's really the same truth there always has been from Psalm 1. And that's one reason why so many of us love this one passage from the Psalms. Today, if you're someone who wants to take the way of delight in the Lord's will and His ways, and if you believe that being united with Christ is the way to do that, then we'd like to offer you the encouragement to act on that good intention of faith. If we can assist you in so doing, please let us know of your desire while we stand and sing this song this morning.